American Public Media.
Before our last hour of Morning Edition, we're going to check in again with Mel Baker, who's taking us, I believe, to Castro Valley.
580 eastbound before Redwood Road, we have a dead deer in the two middle lanes. 880 southbound's connector to southbound 238 in San Leandro. The left lane is blocked by a big rig crash. Traffic is slow back to Marina Boulevard. 680 northbound before 84 west in Sunol. The left lane blocked by some debris. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. We'll see you again at about 8:06. Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise Software Platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. Good morning. I'm Sandy Althaus, and you're listening to member-supported radio. This is KQED-FM, San Francisco, KQEI-FM, North Highlands, Sacramento. The time is 8 o'clock.
Good morning. Families of the Sandy Hook Elementary School students are a big step closer to getting paid in their defamation suit. Alex Jones agreed to liquidate his media empire to pay. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, world champion and Olympic triathletes compete in San Francisco on a new world tour.
Former President Trump campaigned at an Arizona megachurch, his first stop since being convicted. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Michelle Martin. He's partnering there with an outside group that blurs the line between religious revival and American politics. Plus, a new treatment for people who are overheating, a mobile ice bath en route to the hospital. And Nigerian music star Tems releases her debut album, one that exists because she had the courage to quit an old job. It is Friday, June 7th. Australian rapper Iggy Azalea turns 34 years old today. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden has just finished delivering his second major speech in Normandy, France. He's there to commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Biden cited the bravery of American soldiers who stormed the French beaches and began to climb a dangerous cliff to drive back Nazi troops.
Today, as I look out at this battlefield and all the bunkers and bomb craters that are still surrounded, one thought comes to mind. My God. How did they do it?
Biden met earlier today in Paris with Ukraine's president and offered him a fresh aid package worth more than $200 million. Biden is comparing Russia's invasion of Ukraine to the fight against Nazis in World War II. It's not yet summer, but a heat dome is trapping millions of people in dangerous heat in the southwestern U.S. NPR's Amy Held reports temperatures are up to 30 degrees above average for this time of year, topping 110 degrees in some areas.
The desert southwest knows heat, but this heat is different. It came on fast. Glenn Simpson, senior director at Community Ambulance in Nevada, says that's led to more heat-related emergencies for residents.
Locals just aren't used to it. So even though they may have grown up here, their bodies haven't acclimated to that.
Some are more vulnerable.
Those that are unhoused, to the elderly, to children, to those that may have chronic health conditions.
In Phoenix, first responders have a new protocol, putting heat stroke patients in cold water immersion bags. Last year was the hottest on record globally. Now, planet-warming carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has hit a new record, largely from fossil fuel burning. Amy Held, NPR News.
The Washington Post's publisher and chief executive has denied reports by NPR and others that he pressured his own executive editor not to report a damaging story on him. NPR's David Folkenflik reports Will Lewis stands accused in British court of helping to cover up a wide-ranging scandal at Rupert Murdoch's British tabloids more than a dozen years ago.
Lewis denies this, and he hasn't been prosecuted or even named as a defendant in the lawsuits brought by Prince Harry and others. According to four people at the Post, Lewis pressured then-executive editor Sally Busby to drop the story this spring. It published anyway. She was gone 3.5 weeks later as part of a restructuring that would have diminished her job. I had broken the story about the Lewis allegations in the UK back in December. At the time, he tried to induce me to kill my own story by giving me an exclusive interview about his plans for the Post. Yesterday, Lewis said we only spoke off the record, but our agreement didn't extend to such offers, which he did not deny making. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The Labor Department says U.S. employers created more jobs last month than forecasters expected. There were 272,000 new jobs added to the economy in May. The unemployment rate rose slightly to 4%. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 90 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. An upcoming U.S. Supreme Court ruling could change California's ability to allow people to ask a court to take away someone's right to possess a gun if they think that person is dangerous. KQED's Aaron Baldessari explains.
The court is weighing a challenge to a Texas law that allows the government to bar someone with a domestic violence restraining order from possessing guns. California issues similar protective orders for reasons ranging from domestic violence to elder and workplace violence. Attorney General Rob Bonta says the orders save lives.
This is about real people, real lives. We've chosen safety here in California. We've chosen common sense.
Gun rights advocates say there's no proof the orders actually work, pointing to a 16% increase in the rate of gun deaths in California between 2014 and 2022. The Supreme Court decision is expected this month or next. I'm Aaron Baldessari, KQED News.
Contra Costa County prosecutors are charging a Vallejo man with hit and run and driving drunk for injuring two people while he allegedly drove his SUV into a farmer's market in Walnut Creek last weekend. The crash took place as vendors were setting up for the farmer's market on a Sunday morning. Law enforcement officials say 33-year-old Jose Manuel Chavez struck two female victims, causing major injuries. They say he fled the scene but was arrested near the Pleasant Hill Contra Costa Center BART station. The district attorney's office announced the charges yesterday. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com, investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners of KQED. We are off to the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge with Mel Baker.
580 westbound from Castro Street to the tolls is stop and go. But on the Bay Bridge, there is no delay at all as you come up on the metering lights, which, according to the CHP, are still on. But again, I'm seeing no backup there. Coming into San Francisco, 101 northbound from 280 to the hospital curve is slow to stop and go. Mel Baker for KQED.
All right. Thanks, Mel. You'll be back at 819. Coming up on KQED News, artist Joshua Mays, known for his futuristic murals and digital illustrations, opens a new pop-up exhibit tonight. It features a fictional city he invented called Olgaruth. You can hear that coming up at 8:22 on KQED Public Radio. Sunny skies today with highs from the upper 50s at the ocean to the low 80s inland. 76 expected in Napa and Walnut Creek for the high, 83 expected in Livermore, 84 in San Jose, much cooler at the beach in Half Moon Bay with a high of 59 degrees, and here in San Francisco we should see a high of 63. Expect similar temperatures all the way through the weekend, but we'll see a heat bump as we head into the beginning and middle of next week. It's 8:07. This is KQED Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The doctor is in. Dr. Pepper is now the nation's number two soft drink, passing Pepsi. We'll have more on that in a moment. First, we have this story about liquid, or rather, liquidation. Alex Jones is one step closer to paying the families who sued him for defamation.
Jones is a talk show host who built his career on spreading conspiracy theories, and he spread one about the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut in 2012 that killed more than two dozen people, mostly children. He claimed the shooting was fake, and he incited people to harass the families of the victims. A court ordered him to pay $1.5 billion in damages, but he first sought bankruptcy protection and now is moving to resolve the case through Chapter 7. Liquidation.
NPR's Tovia Smith has been following the story. Tovia, good morning.
Good morning.
What does Chapter 7 liquidation mean?
Well, it would basically mean that there'd be a fire sale, a controlled but a swift sale of everything from Jones's ownership in his company called Free Speech Systems to his personal gun collection. Hmm. And it means the ball could get rolling pretty quickly on at least some payment for those Sandy Hook families who won that defamation suit. But the payment wouldn't be anywhere close to what these families are owed. Jones's assets are estimated now at about $10 million, which might mean just around a couple hundred thousand dollars for each of the plaintiffs, at least initially. And I say initially because a Chapter 7 trustee would have authority to hunt down any assets that Jones may have hidden. And this hunting license, as some call it, would be a forever thing because Jones's case, unlike most bankruptcy cases, where debts are washed away and you could get a fresh start, the judge ruled in Jones's case that can't happen because his wrongdoing was intentional and malicious. So bottom line, the families will have a claim on Jones's future earnings for the rest of his life.
Wow. So he gives up $10 million, a tiny fraction of what he owes, and then this would pursue him forever. Why would Jones view that as a good option?
Well, his attorneys say in court papers that there's no hope of settlement or reorganization, and Chapter 7 liquidation would be simpler and cheaper and in everyone's interest. It is curious, though, given that Jones has been pretty obstructive and intransigent since these defamation lawsuits were filed, and I'll say he was especially erratic on his InfoWars show just last weekend, alternating between really angry defiance, screaming, swearing, and vowing to fight, and on the other hand, total despair, literally sobbing about losing his show and his company, which he called his baby.
You know, you note that he's still on the air. He's still doing his show. Would this actually shut down his media empire if they go through with the Chapter 7?
Yes, but with a caveat. And this is important as a lot of the families who sued made it very clear that stopping Jones' conspiracy mongering is more important than any financial windfall. So yes, liquidation would spell the end of his control of his company, but it would not stop him from reincarnating into a new company that does the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And ironically, I'll add, that would mean that the more Jones spews his bogus conspiracy theories and the more money he makes, the more money the families could get paid.
Okay, although I suppose he continues to have freedom of speech and freedom to defame people and then freedom to be responsible for the defamation.
To get sued again.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the judge expected to rule on this request?
The bankruptcy judge will decide next Friday whether Chapter 7 is the way to go here. And meantime, Jones is appealing the defamation cases and the ruling that families can keep chasing him for the rest of his life.
NPR's Tovia Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Former President Trump has made his first campaign stop since his conviction in a New York courtroom last week. He appeared yesterday at a megachurch in Phoenix with Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA. That's a youth-oriented conservative mobilizing group. Turning Point is taking a significant new role with the Trump campaign this cycle. And we're joined now by two of our colleagues to tell us why this matters. NPR's Lisa Hagan, who was at the event in Phoenix, and NPR's Jimena Bustillo, who's been covering Arizona for the election. And she's here with me in the studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I'm going to start with you, Jimena. Trump lost Arizona by about 11,000 votes in 2020. How active has his campaign been there this year?
Well, there just simply has been a limited presence, and particularly from Trump himself. He was scheduled to attend the Arizona GOP's annual dinner in January, but the event was canceled following news of the chairman's resignation. There were also plans for him to visit in March and May, and he went to Ohio and stayed in New York instead. The campaign has told me that these last two were just scheduling conflicts. But investment has also been minimal. In 2020, Trump spent more than $2 million on advertisements between January 1st and June 6th. So far in 2024, he has not spent any money at all, according to our analysis of ad data from the firm Ad Impact. In a way, the group Turning Point Action is looking to fill that void, and they're coordinating with Trump canvassing efforts in Arizona and in a few other swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan as well.
So let me ask you about this. So the door knocking and the canvassing that people associate with like a normal presidential campaign, it's going to be turned over and coordinated with this outside group. Now, I have to ask, is this legal? And one of the reasons I'm asking is that conservative groups have been very aggressively critical, going after in the past progressive groups that do things like register voters. So is this legal?
Well, it is. So the Federal Election Commission issued an advisory opinion earlier this spring that said that it allows campaigns and outside groups such as Turning Point Action to coordinate on this kind of canvassing. The immediate response from the Trump campaign was to invite outside groups to coordinate.
So Lisa, let's go to you. You've been doing some reporting on Turning Point USA. Give us a sense of how important this group is in the universe of conservative organizations.
It's really become a nexus for diehard Trump supporters and conspiracists and increasingly far-right Christianity. Turning Point started as a student organization 12 years ago this week, actually, and it now has $80 million in revenue coming in as of last year. And a lot of that growth has happened. It's doubled and tripled since the pandemic and the org's massive shift towards the religious right.
So obviously Arizona is an important state for the presidential election. Humanists just talked to us about that. Why was the event at this church, and is there something significant about that?
Yes. Kirk's Turning Point organization has spent the last 3 years cultivating support for Trump in Arizona, and he's doing a lot of that at monthly meetings at this exact church. So specifically, he's been helping to fuse that support with people's Christian beliefs, and they've become inseparable here. We met Amber Bonias, and she had two necklace pendants with Trump and Jesus on them outside the event.
We're all here for one cause, and that's for Trump and America and our values, our Judeo-Christian values and what we stand on as a country.
So leaning into this blended religious identity looks to be like a really key component to Turning Point's campaigning strategy here, both in Arizona and across the country.
Okay, but there have been religious components to sort of political organizing for decades, frankly, both on the left and the right. So is there something different about Turning Point's religious outreach?
Absolutely. Great point. Unlike some of the religious political movements of the last several decades, what we see now with Kirk and a significant number of Republicans, honestly, is not just a mission to get Christians involved in politics, but really to take over or to take dominion over the government, education, business, media, essentially every part of culture. And this is not about denominations. It is about uniting around this particular vision of the future and Trump's central role in making it happen.
So, Jimena, final question to you. Jimena, why start in Arizona?
Well, Arizona is Turning Point's home. That's where it was based and created. But the Arizona strategy is truly important to watch in this election. Trump only lost the state by just over 11,000 votes, as you noted earlier. And there are a lot of top issues at play here. It is a border state. It has a very diverse economy and voter base. And an abortion ballot initiative will also be top of mind for voters. So it really is a testing ground for some of these strategies.
That is NPR's Jimena Bustillo. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, and Lisa Hagan, who is in Phoenix. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, one of the country's most famous doctors is getting some long-awaited recognition.
I drink Dr. Pepper and I'm proud. I'm part of an original crowd.
Dr. Pepper just surpassed Pepsi to become the second most popular carbonated beverage in America. Coca-Cola is still number one.
Coca-Cola Classic has about 19% of the carbonated soft drink market in the U.S.
Duane Stanford is the editor and publisher of Beverage Digest.
So then in second place, you've got Dr. Pepper with an 8.3 share,
which is now a carbonated bubble or two ahead of Pepsi.
Now, Dr. Pepper used to market itself as the plucky underdog of soft drinks, but is actually older than Coke or Pepsi. It was invented in Waco, Texas in 1885.
Started off as a regional brand in the Southwest, and it grew over the years, and it's a major national player.
Which Duane Stanford credits to Dr. Pepper's targeted marketing.
They've gone really big on college football. On any given weekend during the championship bowl series, you'll see Dr. Pepper.
There you are. College football playoff trophy. Instead of a Dr. Pepper.
You were like the Greek god of trophies. Classic.
Okay. The soft drink also has a strong presence on TikTok, where Dr. Pepper and pickles has become a thing. Here's TikToker Anna Grace Sims.
The pickles are in there. I even put some pickle juice in there for good measure. And here goes the Dr. Pepper. It's not bad. It's weird, but it's not bad.
Now that's a standard for you. Weird,
I'll take her word for
but
it.
Not bad. Yeah. Duane Stanford says Dr. Pepper has gained ground also because of the choices by the rival it just passed.
Pepsi has invested more in their zero sugar offerings and not as much in Pepsi Cola. They believe that's the future when it comes to carbonated soft drinks.
So Pepsi Cola's down, Dr. Pepper is up, and Stanford anticipates Dr. Pepper will stay in second place.
So cheers to Dr. Pepper, but okay, the pickles. The pickles.
No. Yeah.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, if you drink Dr. Pepper, you're a pepper too.
This is NPR News.
Okay, it's 8:19. Well, let's go check in with Mel Baker, who's taking us to Santa Rosa.
We're seeing the remnants of some slow traffic. It's pretty much thinning out now, but northbound on 101 from Highway 12's interchange to about College Avenue, you'll experience a little bit of slow traffic. Elsewhere, the main challenge in the North Bay still is 37 westbound from Wilson to the lane merge where it's stop and go. Remember, this weekend and starting actually this afternoon, Highway 121 and 37 going to be very busy from a series of races beginning for NASCAR at the raceway. Mel Baker for KQED.
All right. Thanks, Mel. Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. Visitors can explore the wonders of California and see how big, bold, and biodiverse nature can be at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. Tickets at calacademy.org. Sutter Health, with over 3.2 million online appointments and more than 860,000 video visits just last year, Sutter never stops making patients' lives easier. Learn more at sutterhealth.org. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. Coming up at 9 o'clock on Forum, we discuss the opera Innocence, which has made its American premiere in San Francisco. At the heart of the story is a mass shooting at an international school and the grief and trauma that linger a decade later. That's the 9 o'clock hour of Forum, and then at 10...
I'm Leslie McClurg, in for Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., the influence of the Tea Party on American politics. The right-wing populist movement has lost its funding arm as the conservative group Freedom Works shuts down, and as followers join the MAGA movement. We look at the history of the Tea Party and how it's shaped today's GOP. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from Acorn TV, with stories from all around the world in one place. From dramas to mysteries to comedies, Acorn TV offers multiple ways to stream. Subscription options at acorn.tv. USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses turn shipping into an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. And your part-time controller. U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services. yptc.com/NPR. And by the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. A new Pro Sports World Tour is coming to San Francisco this weekend, this time in triathlon, started by the Professional Triathletes Organization. It's called the T100, and they're trying to amplify the world's top triathletes, that is, swimmers, bikers, and runners. To tell us a bit more about the race and the tour, KQED's Kelly O'Mara joins us. Hello.
Hi, Brian.
So I should note, first off, that you are the former editor-in-chief of Triathlete Magazine and now KQED's resident triathlon expert. So tell me, what is this series and how is it different from any of the other races that we have here sometimes or that we hear about?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, San Francisco has a lot of races, and triathlons had famous one-off races before, you know, Ironman, the Olympics, but we've never had a world tour, nothing like the PGA or the tennis tour. And so this is really trying to make that happen. You know, there's $7 million in prize money across the series, eight stops, and one of them's here, right in San Francisco.
Wow. So what exactly are they racing this weekend?
100 kilometers. The organization is very British, so they're always talking in kilometers.
Okay. And how is that broken down?
It's a 2K, or about a mile swim from the middle of the bay. They jump off a boat, about a 50-mile bike up and down San Francisco, and then about an 11-mile run kind of out on the water.
Okay. So Olympic gold medalists, world champions, like 20 of the best. Is there anyone in this group that we might have heard of?
There is an Olympic gold medalist, a couple of world champions at different distances. The women's field is, I mean, this is women's sports era right now, right? And it's super stacked. There is the only athlete to have qualified for two different sports in the Paris Olympics this summer is racing. She'll be doing actually both the triathlon and cycling races in Paris. And then there's my personal favorite, the local favorite, Chelsea Sodaro. She went to Cal, she grew up in Davis, and she was the first new mom to win the Ironman World Championships, that one in Hawaii you maybe have seen on TV.
Wow.
She won it 18 months postpartum, and it was like a really big deal, really kind of changed that conversation about, you know, what moms need in terms of support. I like saw her out running this past weekend. She's a Bay Area girl, so she's going to get a lot of cheers for sure.
So if someone wanted to watch this competition, how can they do it and what should they know?
Yeah, so it does start pretty early on Saturday. They'll be jumping off the boat, the men at 6 a.m., the women at 6:45. But I like to say, like, you can't see anything when they're out in the bay anyway. So if you get there by 7 or 7:30, that's plenty of time. They will be biking up from Crissy Field. So I think probably the best spot to watch is kind of on the west end of Crissy Field by the warming hut, where there's that really steep climb, because then you can see them really, you know, suffering.
Suffer so you can watch others suffer.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. KQED's Kelly O'Mara, thank you.
Thanks.
Artist Joshua Mays moved to the Bay Area 15 years ago, drawn by the vibrant arts community and visionary tech industry. It's been an ideal setting for Mays' futuristic paintings, and now it's a launching pad for a new world he's building with his art, the City of Olgaruth. It's featured in a pop-up exhibit opening tonight in Oakland. KQED culture reporter Ariana Prale has more.
Since Joshua Mays unlocked the door to the City of Olgaruth in his imagination, he's been avidly designing its sci-fi cityscapes and plotting numerous storylines. And he has a soundtrack to scenes like riding the trains of the Olgaruthian Provincial Transit Authority, OPTA for short.
You are at Xanadu Station.
The City of Olgaruth to me is me defining and refining all the ways that I think being alive is cool and colorful and delicious.
Mays, who makes drawings and paintings that often become murals and digital illustrations, got the idea for his fictional city during the pandemic when a lot of his commissioned work shut down. With his time freed up, he began exploring different characters and motifs more deeply. He says he literally took one of his paintings that had a landscape unfolding, drew that part onto a map,
and then broke that down into a topographical landscape, and then broke it down into 31 districts and named it Olgaruth.
The name Olgaruth is a combination of his grandmother's names, Olgar and Ruth. The city's known for its talented visionaries called savants of the spore. Its economy and culture are defined by its special access to the future and centuries worth of technological innovations. Mays is inviting the public to get to know parts of Olgaruth and its characters at a free exhibit. The title is Portal 002, and it's the second in a series of traveling, limited-run shows about Olgaruth he has planned for the Bay Area and beyond.
I like the idea of people coming in and it feeling like you're walking into a pop-up graphic novel.
The three main characters, Montrose Calcott, Cresta Cannon, and Enos Ardley, are all black women, a common subject in Mays's work. They live in districts that have names like Xanadu and Deep Haven. The names were inspired by real streets in Denver, Colorado, where Mays grew up, in Philadelphia, where he spent 8 years, and in his current home of Oakland.
The streets from my old neighborhood actually sound like some Middle Earth, you know, fantastical, like Kalamath and Elmendorf. And I was very fascinated by that aspect of coming up with the names of these places.
Now decades into his career, Mays feels like he's found his magnum opus in Olgaruth, and he's not shying away from his ambitions for it. He plans to eventually pitch Olgaruth to animation studios and video game developers.
It is the culmination of many inner children that have just been given permission to be themselves and to realize that there's tremendous value in that.
Mays hopes his Portals exhibits will inspire others to pursue their boldest ideas with less fear and experience the kind of gratitude he's feeling to be on this passion-filled, purposeful journey.
If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I love that I'm facing in this direction towards my highest, happiest, most joyful, empowered self.
Where all signs point to Olga Ruth.
You are at North Station.
I'm Ariana Prale, KQED News.
Portal 002, a pop-up exhibit by Joshua Mays, is on view tonight through Tuesday at the nonprofit Beats, Rhymes, and Life in Oakland. For more info, visit kqed.org/arts. I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Brian will be back in just a couple of minutes with more news. First, though, Mel Baker back with an accident in the East Bay.
In Fremont, southbound 880, just after Stevenson Boulevard, a crash has left a bumper in the middle lane. The backup is to Highway 84. Jumping up to Concord, Highway 4 westbound after Willow Pass Road, the right lane blocked by a crash there. Traffic slow back to Bailey Road. Mel Baker for KQED.
All right. Thanks for the correction, Mel. Talk to you in a few. Save the Bay. Support for KQED comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. This future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. Listeners can explore their brews wherever fine beverages are sold and learn how trailblazing runs in the family by visiting SierraNevada.com. KQED-FM San Francisco, it's 8:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is delivering a forceful defense of democracy during events commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. He's in Normandy, at a landmark where U.S. Army Rangers captured a heavily fortified German position during the Allied invasion and helped end World War II. Biden drew comparisons between then and now on the threat of dangerous ideology.
They fought to vanquish a hateful ideology in the 30s and 40s. Does anyone doubt they wouldn't move heaven and earth to vanquish hateful ideologies of today?
Biden drew a direct line from the Allied fight to defeat the Nazis in the Second World War to the current Allied support for Ukraine's defense against Russia's invasion. Millions of people across the Southwest may get a break, a slight break, from a punishing heat wave of triple-digit temperatures. At the National Weather Service, meteorologist Frank Pereira is monitoring some of the highest temps.
We have seen temperatures reach above 110 degrees in areas and across portions of southern Nevada, Arizona. That would include Las Vegas, Phoenix. Both have topped out above 110.
But Pereira says temperatures are projected to cool down modestly this weekend into the early part of next week. The Dow is up 92 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. This week's California Supreme Court ruling that lets UC Berkeley start construction on student and supportive housing in People's Park also gives the green light to a much larger campus expansion project. KQED's Aditi Bundlamudi reports.
Opponents of both projects argued the university should have studied alternative sites for construction and considered the amount of noise that students living in that new housing would generate. But the court rejected those arguments. Harvey Smith is the president of the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group.
So all that has been ignored and unnecessarily, because we don't have to choose between a park and housing. We can have both.
UC Berkeley's long-range development plan would add about 12,000 beds for undergraduate and graduate students, effectively doubling the number of beds the university currently provides. I'm Aditi Bundlamudi, KQED News.
Caltrans plans to close one of the eastbound bores of the Caldecott Tunnel overnight three times next week to make repairs after a vehicle fire earlier this week. The agency says it will close bore number two, the left of the two eastbound tunnels, from 10 p.m. Monday to 4:30 a.m. Tuesday, and again the next two nights. Caltrans says crews plan to clean out soot in the tunnel caused by Tuesday's fire. In sports, the Mariners shut out the A's 3-0. The A's start hosting the Blue Jays this evening. The Giants are in Texas for the weekend, starting up at 5-hour time against the Rangers. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. The producers, reporters, and hosts of KQED Public Radio are represented by the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. Plan your perfect summer with a little help from KQED. Our summer guides highlight the best local events, from live music to theater. Start exploring today at kqed.org/summerguide2024. Sunny skies today, highs ranging from the upper 50s to the low 80s, some gusty winds in the afternoon, too. Support for NPR comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Think or Swim. Learn more at schwab.com. And by the listeners of KQED. It is the 7th day of June, and it's a Friday. Good morning. The time is 8:34.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. If you live in parts of the west or southwest U.S., then you already know it's really hot this week. Heat-related deaths in Phoenix have skyrocketed in the past decade. So first responders are using a new treatment during heat emergencies. Catherine Davis-Young with member station KJZZ has this report.
Outside Valleywise Health Medical Center in Phoenix, a mannequin lying on the sidewalk represents someone who's passed out in scorching heat. Captain John Prado with the Phoenix Fire Department says the most important thing is to cool the patient down quickly. The way to do that is with a huge, watertight bag.
We're going to place them in this bag. There's a lot of things happening at this point. We're starting multiple IVs.
He pulls bags of ice out of a cooler, tears them open, and dumps ice in with the patient. Then he zips the bag up to the mannequin's chest.
If we can cut down 20, 30 minutes just cooling them during drive time to the hospital, that shows an increase in survivability.
The Phoenix Fire Department started trying out these cold water immersion bags last summer. This year, it's the official protocol for heat stroke. Doctors at the Valleywise ER have seen heat stroke cases soar in recent years. On average, last summer, these patients came to the hospital with body temperatures of 107. 40% of them died. Dr. Jeffrey Stowell says some survivors were left with neurological damage.
For lack of a better word, they're cooking their brains during this time, and the longer their temperature is high and the longer their brain is hot, the worse their outcome will be.
Stowell says fans and ice packs had been standard treatment, but those methods can take over an hour to cool a heat stroke patient. So a few years ago, Valleywise began using the ice-filled bags, a method used by the military and sports doctors. Stowell says they saw patients improve in 10 to 30 minutes.
They're pretty unresponsive at those temperatures. It is not uncommon, though, as we cool them, when they get down to a normal temperature, that they start to wake up, and even at times will wake up and start talking to us and kind of respond immediately.
Other Phoenix area ERs have adopted similar techniques, but it's not common practice around the country. Nationwide, more and more people are suffering heat-related illnesses as climate change drives more frequent heat waves. Valleywise emergency doctor Jeffrey Comp says the ice-filled bags could be a valuable tool for other hospitals. He says he's heard from former medical students.
They're telling me, hey, I did it up in Idaho. I did it over in California, and it's really encouraging to see that the work that we're doing here in Phoenix is hopefully taking off in other parts of the country.
Comp hopes that will mean more lives saved. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
We have the story behind a headline. Some big furniture companies are cutting prices at a time when Americans remain worried about inflation. One of the price cutters is IKEA. The Sweden-based company has cut prices three times in a year. So we called up Javier Quiñones, who is the president of IKEA Retail in the United States. And his explanation of the price cuts opens a window on the wider economy.
It is an answer to the economic situation and what is top of mind for consumers these days. During COVID, of course, we all know what happened with the supply chain disruption. And it had massive impact in availability and also in the price of products. And we have seen during the last couple of years inflation also going to the roof. And this is one of the top of mind things for consumers.
I'm interested in other economic effects to your specific business. You mentioned the supply chain disruptions, which affected almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering also if during the pandemic, when people were spending more time at home, they were spending more time ordering and installing furniture, and maybe now they're spending less time doing that.
We saw at the very beginning of the pandemic, more on the functional side. So I need something like a desk. I need something like reconvert this room to somewhere where I can now work.
Hmm.
To then later, also some bigger changes like kitchens or full bedrooms, painting homes and improving our homes, no? And it is true that also slowed down a little bit. And we see our industry and we see the home furnishing business now getting reduced in size.
The home furnishing business is getting reduced in size, you said.
Yeah, it's of course, as you said, right? During the pandemic, we saw an increase in a big demand, and there is a shift in the way consumers look at the spending their money and their savings.
Have you had to push down on your suppliers a little bit for them to reduce the prices of what they send you?
Well, what we saw is after COVID and after all this disruption, right, that raw material mainly and transport are the two big drops in cost. Then there is, of course, as you know, we design our products and we create the price tag in many ways before we create the product. So there are a lot of innovation and a lot of technology applied to new products. That's why we can do what we are doing.
What does this mean for your profits, which, if I'm not mistaken, have been pretty high?
You know, IKEA is here for the very, very long term. When we obviously reduce the price of our products, of course, in the very short term, this has an impact in the profits, absolutely, and it has an impact also in the revenue. But these days, we believe that this is the right thing to do. So what we see is that despite of lower profits and lower revenue, we see an increase in the amount of customers we have, which is looking at it from the market situation and economy situation perspective, fantastic news for us.
One final thing to put this in a broader context. You told me that there has been some shrinkage in the whole industry, the sector that you're in, furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Target has also announced price reductions. There are a lot of retailers of different kinds that are cutting prices now. What does this tell us about the retail economy and about inflation?
Well, I think we see probably two things. One, consumers are more cautious about where and how they are spending their money. And that, of course, in some industries reduces the demand, and then there is a reaction on the price, right? So that's the very first one. I think the second is obviously an improvement in the cost structure. And that's the second part. We see the benefits or the improvement in the cost structure of our products from the supply and transport. And, of course, we adapt this and pass it to consumers.
Javier Quiñones of IKEA, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
His company has cut prices three times in a year. After we spoke with Mr. Quiñones, we wanted an outside perspective, so we sent that interview along to NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, who listened and sent us a voice memo.
Furniture sales tend to rise and fall with the housing market, and we know that high mortgage rates have been a drag on home sales, and that's weighing down everything that goes into a home. Furniture sales in April were down more than 8% from a year ago. Now, people who shop at IKEA, like people who shop at Target or McDonald's, tend to be very price sensitive. So all those businesses are working hard to get prices to a point where it won't be a turnoff for those customers. It certainly helps when raw material costs come down or transportation gets cheaper. You also heard Mr. Quiñones talk about redesigning products to hit a certain price. Often that means doing without some feature that you hope the customer doesn't miss. IKEA is known for that kind of value engineering. And I say that as someone who's sitting in a room full of one, two, three, four Billy bookcases.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent and furniture buyer Scott Horsley. This is NPR News.
Coming up, it's time for perspectives. Right now, though, traffic off to the North Bay this time. Here's Mel Baker.
In San Rafael, 101 northbound before North San Pedro, a stall in the center lane. They're in the process of clearing that out. It's slow back to Irwin Street. 37 westbound from Wilson to the lane merge. That's stop and go. And 80 westbound on the Bay Bridge Toll Plaza. There's no delay. Traffic moving well across the span. Mel Baker for KQED.
All right, that's worth a horn toot. We'll talk to you at 8:49. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Time now for a perspective. For listener Steve and Sam, the life of his father, long ago passed away, is only slightly captured in a handful of mementos.
Come June, like a lot of people, I think about my father. For him, this was a time of joy. Father's Day, his wedding anniversary, and for a high school math teacher who clocked 3 decades in that role, June brought school's end. Also, like a lot of folks, I've tried over the past year to sort priorities and clutter, what to hang on to, how to ensure the days matter. One piece of paper I've kept, in a flimsy frame propped against a shelf of poetry books, was given to my father by his grandparents. Issued by the U.S. Treasury War Finance Committee in 1945, it certifies 7-year-old Boyd as owner of a war bond, thereby becoming an investor in this country's fight for human liberty and a contributor in a world struggle to make life free and forever peaceful for all men. Encircling the text are 22 familiar faces, including Thumper, Donald, Goofy, all 7 dwarfs, Mickey in the upper right. Another paper, hand-calligraphied and mounted on oak, was presented by the Board of Trustees in the village where we lived in the outskirts of Chicagoland, in appreciation for his years as Superintendent of Roads and Forester and Weeds Commissioner. I remember those years in the late 70s. In the Midwest, when a snowstorm hit in the winter, the phone line installed in our living room would ring loud and shrill at 5 a.m., time for the snowplows to hit the roads. On the Certificate of Appreciation, dangling from an illuminated letter T, is a vine of 3 pink blossoms and 1 blue, the stamen of a flower just about kissing the F in Forester. But I can let this go. Those years were just a sliver of his life, one that ended too soon. It was in June, almost 30 years ago, that he retired. His last day of work, he had a stroke. He never came home. He was 55. For me, each year brings increasing poignancy just how young that is. But then the pandemic has driven home lessons of terrible loss for so many. As for the bond from a time of global conflict, I'll keep that a bit longer. It's a gateway to my father's childhood, epic backdrop to the beginning of his story. With a perspective, I'm Stephen Sam.
Stephen Sam is a magazine editor living in San Jose. You can hear more perspectives on our podcast. Just search KQED's Perspectives wherever you get your podcasts. And support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and providing financial donations to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. The Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And by the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A very old commercial celebrates American things. It said, "We love baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet." All those things still have their fans, I guess, but if you redid the commercial today, you might have to include cricket.
The red, white, and blue of USA has overcome the 2022 finalists.
That's the sound as the United States men's team defeated Pakistan in Dallas yesterday at the T20 Cricket World Cup. Wow. Jack Hope is following all this. He co-hosts the Cricket Podcast in the UK. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I feel the need to explain for some large part of our audience what cricket is. Is this fair? It's a little like baseball, but not really like baseball at all.
It has like the same skills that you'd require in baseball. You need to be able to throw and hit and catch and things like that, but the rhythms of the game are quite different, yeah.
Okay, and we have a game that is huge in large parts of the world, including South Asia, huge, huge sport in Pakistan, which had a great team. So how did the Americans beat them?
Well, it's a classic David v. Goliath story, isn't it? How did America beat them? What happened is that America played really good cricket on the day. They caught well, they fielded well, they batted well, and then when it came to the crunch at the end of the game, they were better under pressure. Their batters executed, and their bowler, Netravalka, was excellent with the ball.
Can I just understand, this is like overtime at the end of the game, right? There's tied at the end?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. It's like one extra innings, except the innings is really short, if that kind of makes sense. Like, instead of playing a whole game once more, you take a really, really small part of that, maybe like a penalty shootout in soccer, and that decides the winner.
Can we get some of the cultural backdrop here? I know that there have been a lot of changes in the United States. I can remember myself many years ago doing a story in New York City about tons and tons of people playing cricket in New York City parks. Is this sport gaining in popularity in the United States?
That seems to be the case. So my understanding is that there are 200,000 weekly cricketers in the USA, which is, you know, about a third of the number in the UK. So it's not a small number of people playing. According to the data that's out there, between 5 and 50 million people in the USA have shown some interest in cricket. And the whole point of this tournament, in a way, is to introduce the game more broadly and to try and engage some of the people that have shown that interest in the sport on an ongoing basis.
Oh, so it was a strategic move to hold this tournament in the United States as opposed to elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a commercial endeavor, pure and simple. There's lots of investment going into cricket in the USA at the moment. There's a new tournament called Major League Cricket, which is going into its second season. They'll be starting in about a month's time. And we're seeing a lot of money go into specific areas with a view to making it a big niche sport. Like, I don't think the expectation is it will overtake baseball or something like that, but yeah, it will provide something for the people that are interested.
Big niche sport. I guess we should just note, is it fair to say that in India and Pakistan and the UK and some other places, this is the sport or one of the handful of sports?
Oh, absolutely. In India and Pakistan, it's the number one. There's a reason it's the second most watched sport in the world, and it's those two countries, basically.
Jack Hope, co-host of the Cricket Podcast in the UK. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
This is NPR News.
We've got the California Report coming up next. And Mel Baker is back looking at something on the Altamont Pass now.
Yeah, you know, this has been our big slow and big problem all morning long. 580 westbound before North Flynn Road is pretty much stopped back to the 205 split there. And then 205 itself westbound is backed up to about 11th Street. This is all due to a big rig that went off over the road in about 1 this morning. They've brought in special equipment. They're working very carefully with CAL FIRE to prevent it from starting a fire when they pull it out of there at about 9 this morning. Meanwhile, 880 southbound before Stevenson Boulevard in Fremont, the right lane there blocked by a three-car crash. It's stop and go back to Dakota Road. Mel Baker, 4KQED.
All right. Thanks, Mel. Support for KQED comes from the Asian Art Museum. Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org. Listen to KQED throughout each weekday for clues to our 5:48 p.m. news quiz. And when you hear that quiz question, go to kqed.org/radio-news-quiz to enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay with our sponsor, Canyon Ranch Woodside. And good luck.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Mavi Bolaños in San Francisco, and these are your state headlines. The city of Fresno could have avoided losing more than $600,000 in an online phishing scam in 2020. That's according to a new report by the Fresno County Civil Grand Jury, a watchdog for county government and public agencies. The report found if the city had followed its own established policies, the loss would not have happened. The city did not inform the public about the scam until it was reported by the Fresno Bee in 2022. The FBI investigated the case and found that this phishing scam was part of a larger international organized crime ring. The agency found local governments across the country were also scammed in a similar way. Three Jewish UCLA students filed a federal lawsuit against the UC Regents and several university officials this week. They allege that pro-Palestinian protesters block them from entering certain areas on campus by locking arms and preventing people who refuse to disavow Israel from passing through. The lawsuit claims the UCLA administration knew about these actions and did nothing. And the state trial for a man who violently attacked former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband is now on hold for at least a week after a judge dismissed several of the charges against him. KQED's Alex Hall reports.
David DePapp's attorneys had argued that California law protects him from being prosecuted again after he was already convicted in federal court for the same acts. Judge Harry Dorfman granted part of their motion, dismissing charges including attempted murder, elder abuse, and assault with a deadly weapon. He kept an aggravated kidnapping charge, which carries a life sentence without the possibility of parole. DePapp is also still charged with first-degree burglary, among other state crimes. Attorneys on both sides say they'll go to the California Court of Appeal to challenge the judge's decision. For the California Report, I'm Alex Hall in San Francisco.
California has funded over 4 million tax-free saving accounts for students to pay for college. But many families don't seem to know that money's there. CalMatters College Journalism Fellow Jacqueline Muniz has more on the state's CalKids program.
The state launched the California Kids Investment and Development Savings Program in 2022 to help seed college savings accounts. Yet, as of early May, families have claimed just over 313,000 out of the more than 4 million accounts. That's according to tracking from inside the state treasurer's office. Officials say they've seen a boost in uptake after certain targeted marketing efforts, but there are millions in marketing dollars for the program that the state still hasn't spent. Deposits for the CalKids program vary, but range from $100 to $1,500. Students can use the money for tuition and fees, books and supplies, and room and board.
That's CalMatters College Journalism Fellow Jacqueline Muniz.
Support for the California Report comes from Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and adult and children's health systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. Monterey Bay Aquarium, inspiring conservation of the ocean through amazing live exhibits and global action to protect the ocean from plastic pollution, climate change, and overfishing. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery. On the web at schmidtocean.org.
San Francisco could soon begin soliciting private donations to cover the cost of hosting two Chinese pandas at the city's zoo. The zoo will need to pay millions towards a new panda enclosure and pay fees to China, leading residents to express concerns about the cost. Animal rights activists also questioned whether the zoo is up for the task, given recent allegations of mismanagement. Fleur Doss, with the group In Defense of Animals, spoke at a committee hearing on the plan.
The zoo has repeatedly proven it is incapable of handling major infrastructure projects which drag on for years while animals suffer in temporary holding.
Mayor London Breed is seeking an exemption from city ethics rules so that she can seek donations for the Panda Project from people who have business before the city. The Board of Supervisors will discuss the request at next week's meetings. And now to a preview of our sister show, The California Report's weekly magazine, featuring deep dive stories and documentaries about the Golden State. Here's host Sasha Coca to tell you what's on the show this week.
Well, we're kicking off a new series about California composers, people who write music from different corners of the state and in different genres. We'll meet Jens Ibsen, who was born in Ghana and lives in Pacifica. He puts a new spin on classical music inspired by prog rock and heavy metal.
I just was like, oh my God, like you have these metal guys like singing notes that you never hear in opera, you know?
We'll also head to Riverside to check out a taco joint that's got a huge orange butterfly hanging off the side of the building. It's got an airplane on the roof and hundreds of sculptures made from what most people would consider trash.
Yo le vi la oportunidad a la basura, al reciclaje. Okay, no tengo dinero para comprar los materiales.
It's all the work of folk artist and immigrant entrepreneur Martin Sanchez, who finds inspiration in the bottles and the cans his restaurant throws away.
Pero tengo botellas, tengo botes, tengo lo que desecha el restaurante.
Plus, we'll hear about another kind of creative recycling, a Santa Cruz company using old hospital trays to make 3D printed transparent surfboards.
Like midday, where the sun's shining right through it on a green wave, it just glows.
Thanks, Sasha. You can tune into the California Report magazine on their podcast or on your local public radio station. And that is the California Report for Friday, June 7th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. Our engineers are Brendan Willard, Danny Bringer, Catherine Monahan, and Seal Muller. Our producers are Billy Cruz and Keith Mizuguchi. Our senior editor is Angela Corral. Our vice president of news is Ethan Tobin-Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Madi Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Stay with us. Forum is coming up next. First, though, Mel Baker is back winding up his traffic reporting for the morning in San Francisco.
101 southbound, just north of Silver, the slow lane blocked by some debris. It's stop and go northbound on 101 from 280 up to the hospital curve. No delays on the Bay Bridge, where the metering lights are may or may not.